Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to ADR Hub's web panel discussion series. I thank everyone for being a part of this today, and I want to introduce my co-facilitator, Brian Hansen, who will be working with us today. Brian?
Hi, thanks, Jeff, and thank you for everyone for joining us. We have a very large group today, and we want to get started. I know we're already a little bit late. My name is Brian Hansen from the Werner Institute, and you're here today at a presentation on conflict resolution and climate change. We have Ken Cloak with us, who is a renowned author, mediator, and founder of Mediation Beyond Borders, and he will be our guest speaker today, along with Eileen Barker. So I'm going to keep it short here. I know Ken wants to get into it, so I'm going to hand over the floor to Ken. And Ken, just to let you know, your slides are on the side, so you can go ahead and choose to go through them at your leisure.
Terrific. Thank you very much. And thanks for hosting this. Thanks to all the people at Creighton for making this happen. Thanks to all the people who have been hanging on patiently. I'm hoping, Eileen, that you'll just kind of jump in when you have things that you would like to add. And I'd like to give a kind of an overview and identify initially how serious this problem is, the class of problems that it belongs to, and what the consequences of our looking at these problems, I think, will be for mediation. Let's think for a minute about the problem of climate change. The difficulty I think that we all see is that there is an enormous set of changes that are taking place around the world, and climate change is simply one of them. And I think we can also see that the consequences of not addressing these issues are going to be rather serious. I don't know if you're able to get, I guess it's slide number two up. Maybe it's slide number three. It's called Problems That Are Global in Nature. Jeff, do you think, is that possible?
Yep, it's coming up right now.
Okay, great. So here are some of the problems that it seems to me we have to begin to come to grips with that are creating conflicts that are not simply incidental or accidental, but chronic, social, and endemic. And these problems include the size and density of human populations, as you can see, CO2 and methane emissions that are resulting in global warming, the expansion of military technology, species extinctions, loss of drinkable water, resistance to antibiotics and the increasing cost of medical care, vulnerability to pandemics, unregulated economic transactions, etc. So you can, as you go down this list, you can see that there are a large number of problems that are extremely difficult to handle. The important element for us about this is to ask ourselves the question, what is not going to help us solve them? And the answer to that question is, first, military force, because you can't solve the problem of bird flu by arresting people or attacking them or declaring war on them. Second, treaties and international agreements. While these may be helpful in eliminating a number of problems, clearly so far as whaling is concerned, we run into a number of difficulties enforcing treaties and international agreements. And so far as the Amazonian rainforest is concerned, it would be very difficult for any international agreement to actually become an effective preventative measure in stopping people from deforestation. The third is legal interventions and the rule of law, meaning the International Court of Justice, lawsuits that are filed in the national courts of various countries. None of these are actually going to prevent global warming from happening. They may be useful in implementing global warming, but they're not actually going to stop them from happening. And I think we can go on, and as we go on, we see that mechanisms that we have created for solving problems can't solve these problems. Diplomacy is one of those, but there's a deeper consequence to the idea of diplomacy, and that is when we are looking at things like unregulated economic transactions or bird flu or climate change or any of those things, we also have to conclude that the nation state as a problem-solving instrument is no longer capable of solving this problem. I think we have to also go further and say that capitalism as a system and market principles are not only not solving the problem, in many ways, they're making it worse. And finally, the United Nations, as presently constituted, can't actually solve the problem. It is too weak to be able to do this. So the question that follows this analysis is, what's left? What is going to help us solve these problems? And I think that the short answer to that is conflict resolution, collaborative negotiation, public dialogue, and all of the techniques that we have been learning and figuring out how to use. So here's the problem. If we start to look at what causes global warming, one of the things that Eileen and I saw in Copenhagen in our visit there on behalf of Mediators Beyond Borders is that the diplomatic approach was singularly unsuccessful in overcoming the natural self-interest of individual nation states. Everybody who was there basically was looking out for themselves, and that's the nature of the nation state, is to help people within a given geographical area advance their self-interest against the self-interest of others. But what we learn in conflict resolution is that's not a very effective way of solving problems. So what we early on realized was that assuming that there is a treaty that eventually emerges from all of these conversations, how is it going to be enforced? Who's actually going to make it work? What's going to happen when there are conflicts? And here's what the answer is. You can either take about 10 years to go through the International Court of Justice, or you can use a United Nations method called conciliation. But here's what conciliation consists of. In order to go to conciliation, you have to have experienced the problem for at least a year. And then what happens is the United Nations appoints a group of conciliators who act as judges and issue a kind of advisory arbitration award that is non-binding and that might help resolve the conflict. And basically, that's it. There is no preference for mediation, and I think we can easily see that the conflict between the United States and China, as an illustration, over CO2 emissions is one that, without mediation, is just simply not going to get solved. Well, I think we can, if you want, maybe what we can do is skip forward to the next slide, which is 12 sources of ecological collapse. This is basically a kind of repetition of the chart that that Jeff showed us before, except that it comes from Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. And what he does is, the entire book is a series of case studies of real times and places when these 12 problems created a kind of ecological and social collapse. Now let's take a look for a second at what needs to happen in order to be able to address the problem of global warming. First of all, I think probably everyone on the call is aware of the fact that the way global warming works is that there are different types of gases in the atmosphere of the Earth. Some of those allow sunlight in and allow it to escape, and others allow sunlight in and do not allow it to escape. CO2 is one of those greenhouse gases that increases the temperature of the atmosphere. And what most people are not aware of is that CO2 has a half-life of about 1,000 years. The real problem, however, is not CO2. The real problem is that what CO2 will do is melt the snow that is reflecting light back into space, melt the surface of the Arctic tundra, and heat the oceans, allowing for the release of enormous quantities of methane gas, which is about 25 times more powerful than CO2. Now, the consequences of this are huge, and I think everyone, certainly on the East Coast and throughout most of the United States, has had an experience of a very warm summer and of climate fluctuations. These are absolutely predicted by the scientific model of what happens in global warming. But the difficulty is, of course, you can't tell exactly what's happening by 1 year's temperature. But at the same time, what we can see is that there's a trend taking place. If you want to take a look, Jeff, maybe at if you want to skip ahead to slide 10, or I guess it must be slide 9 on your chart, which is CO2 and temperature. This is a chart that shows in the red line what is actually happening with global temperatures. If we don't actually address the problem very, very quickly, you can begin to see that this exponential curve is going to go off the charts. And as it does that, what will happen is it will begin to self-reinforce and create other conditions that will make it more difficult to solve the problem. Here's the difficulty with exponential change. I'd like to use a mathematical example as a way of explaining this, because I think it makes it very, very clear. If you imagine for a moment that you have a glass, a cup, a bottle, let's say, and in the bottle are two bacteria, and let's imagine that we know in advance that those bacteria are going to double in size every minute. And let's imagine that we also know that at the end of 1 hour, they are going to fill the bottle. The question is, how much warning time do the bacteria have that they're about to fill the bottle? And the answer is, at 1 minute to the hour, the bottle is only half full. At 2 minutes to the hour, the bottle is only a quarter full. And we are, regarding climate change right now, basically looking at a bottle that is about a quarter to a half full. The difficulty in getting agreement between the various nation states is one that is we could see up close and personal in Copenhagen. For the developed countries, this is less serious because there are available technologies that will allow us to bypass, for example, coal-fired power plants. But in the developing world, that isn't the case. They require technologies that use a great deal more coal and also methane, which, for example, is released in huge amounts. by the burning of cattle dung in places like India and Bangladesh. So the problem is somewhat similar to the problem of bird flu or any or the devastation of the rainforests or any of these difficulties. The difficulty is poor people are not going to do it. They can't afford to do it. They're desperately trying to hang on and survive. And so the lack of economic equality between nation states is a potential source of failure for any climate change agreement. What this means is the advanced nation states are simply not going to be able to impose their will on the underdeveloped countries of the world and have that be successful. The most difficult problem I think that we face is that it's not just a question of rich versus poor or the distribution of available resources. It's a problem created by the fact that enormous amounts of money are being made by exploiting these natural resources. This has been actually sort of the source of genius of capitalism, the source of its immense, unbelievable success and growth. But it's also, going forward, the source of its impending failure. And I think we can see in the British Petroleum oil spill off the Gulf Coast that when profitability is at stake, people cut corners. And they're likely to be cutting corners in this area as well. But the difficulty is there aren't that many corners left to cut. We're facing tremendous problems, not just as a result of the fact that things will be warmer, but the consequences of things being warmer. What is likely to happen by the end of the century if we don't solve this problem is that New York City will have the temperature of Miami. Seattle will have the temperature of Los Angeles. Los Angeles will have the temperature of Mexico City. And what that means is that all of the wheat growing areas in the United States will disappear. The Central Valley of California, that's responsible for the greatest agricultural production of any area of land on the planet, will also disappear. It won't be sustainable. And this is simply one, as I indicated before, of a number of problems that are unsustainable. If you can turn to slide 22, projected temperature increases, this is what it looks like. These are the temperature increases. Notice that the greatest one is along the North Pole. But because of the fact that it's along the North Pole, it means the Greenland ice sheet is in tremendous jeopardy. And what scientists have discovered is that the water is flowing off that ice sheet at a huge rate. This means that virtually all of the, by the end of the century, it is entirely possible that all of the major low-lying cities and areas of the world will be underwater. This includes most of New York City, where the Holland Tunnel is only 9 feet above sea level. And it includes, obviously, enormous amounts of the Netherlands and Denmark, but it also includes about 80% of Bangladesh. And where are those people going to go? What's going to happen to them? What are the conflicts that are going to take place as a result? We can begin to figure out exactly, you know, kind of where we're headed by thinking about a slightly different problem. here's basically what has been happening in connection with the H5N1 virus, the bird flu virus. As most of you know, we are not yet completely out of the woods regarding the possibility of a global pandemic in terms of bird flu. But here's what happens. Bird flu is communicated to human beings mostly by people who raise chickens and ducks and geese and eat them, and those are mostly poor people. And there are a lot of people like that in Indonesia. So what has happened is that there have been various outbreaks of bird flu in Indonesia, but they've all been contained, and none of them has had the genetic makeup that would transform it into something like the Spanish influenza. But what has happened in the last several years is that the Indonesian government has been providing blood samples of people who come down with bird flu to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization has turned it over to the pharmaceutical companies to make vaccines. And then they've taken those vaccines and sold them on the world market, but the Indonesian government can't afford to purchase the vaccines to inoculate its own citizens, especially the ones who are poor and can't afford medical care hardly at all. So what's happened recently is that a woman has been elected in Indonesia as the Minister of Health or something like that, and she has said, we're not giving you the blood samples anymore. And of course she's right, because she's looking out for her constituency, and of course the World Health Organization is right, because they're looking out for world health generally, but they can't make vaccine. And of course the pharmaceutical companies are right, because they have to make a profit in producing the vaccine, and the whole thing makes no sense at all. So well, let me just take 1 minute to summarize the bottom line of this. Here's how we're going to solve these problems. We're going to bring the Minister of Health from Indonesia and the World Health Organization and the pharmaceutical companies and whoever else is potentially impacted by the problem into the same room, and we're going to negotiate a solution to the problem. And we're going to have to do exactly the same thing with regard to climate change, except we can't any longer do it exclusively at the highest level. We also have to use mediation skills at a local level to convince people of the importance of this problem for their future and the future of their grandchildren. So here's the basic idea. We are right now, I think, learning conflict resolution skills, not merely in order to be able to make a nice living doing wonderful work, but I believe there is another reason why we are involved in this, and that is there isn't going to be any other way of solving these problems. And therefore, what we need to do basically is to commit, as Mediators Beyond Borders is committing now, to increase conflict resolution capacity around the world. That's kind of the shorthand version of this. And Eileen, I'm sorry I sort of went on there. And if you'd like to jump in and say something about Copenhagen, please go ahead.
No, I think that's the perfect segue, Ken, in bringing this around to why this is so imperative, that this conflict resolvers, and why we're doing what we're doing and teaching what we teach and learning what we learn. And I think that's a really good jumping off point for, as Jeff said, some Q&A and comments from everyone. So why don't we go and open it up?
So I have just been familiarizing myself with the United Nations conciliation format. If you're suggesting, Susan Davidson in Berkeley, if you're suggesting that we attempt to influence the grassroots and all of those communities that we touch upon in our practice to become involved in this issue, wouldn't it be helpful at the same time to start from the top and try to influence the United Nations climate change interests to alter this conciliation format to make it a more inclusive kind of roundtable with the stakeholders all present, so that a result can be effectuated in very short time, so that we're not lagging.
Yes, absolutely. And so what happened is when we first became involved in this, Mediators Beyond Borders was the only mediation organization accepted as a non-governmental observer, as an NGO, for the Copenhagen climate change talks. And now there have been a series of other meetings as well. So we're present at all those meetings. But the very first thing that we did was to take a look at the existing apparatus and see where there were difficulties. And it turns out there's a little provision in the conciliation agreement that says that the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change can agree on an annex on conciliation defining what conciliation is. So we wrote a proposed annex, essentially a treaty agreement, and we have been circulating it to all the various parties, handing it out to everybody who was interested at Copenhagen, and we've received very good feedback on it. And the basic idea is to do exactly what you're suggesting, which is to expand conciliation to include mediation and to make mediation the very first step of choice, to have the United Nations environmental section basically focus its energies on developing their conflict resolution capacity, finding mediators who could mediate these disputes around the world, but also creating a culture of conflict resolution so that when problems do occur, people think about conflict resolution rather than thinking about military force.
Well, Susan Davidson again. So appended to this proposal to add mediation to this conciliation framework, could there be a some kind of explanation that piques the interest of each of the stakeholders so that they look at mediation as the least expensive, least time-consuming, most expeditious way of approaching this problem in their interest? Because as you said earlier, your observations about capitalism and nationalism, if the stakeholders are not approached in their own self-interest, if they don't see some advantage to themselves in participating and in participating with certain urgency, they will be less likely to want to give up the financial gains that they have and the financial pressures that they have on them to maintain the status quo.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. What we have been doing about this so far, and we haven't done nearly enough, is really two things. One, we put together a fact sheet on the costs of environmental mediation compared to the cost of not mediating. And I don't know if you know Kirk Emerson, but she's been a very active environmental mediator, and she helped put together that material. We also have been trying to develop case studies from all around the world that show how in your area we have environmental disputes have been successfully mediated. And the final thing that we've done is to try to translate some of these into Chinese. We don't have any other translations yet, but so far we've translated the treaty language and the fact sheet and one of the case studies into Chinese. And the Mediators Beyond Borders team that went to Bonn in the latest set of conversations that took place just 2 months ago met with the Chinese and presented that to them. But we need to do a lot more of what you're talking about. I think we all know that we have been making these arguments for years. We have been talking about the advantages of mediation, the cost effectiveness of mediation, all of these things we have been discussing. And we haven't really formulated this on a global scale yet, mm-hmm. but it's possible to, I think, with the participation of people around the world, develop materials and approaches that are going to be much more effective internationally. I hope that's helpful, but basically I think you're completely right and we have to do a lot more of it.
Well, I'm seeing something here that's kind of a recurring theme in this text box over here, and it kind of goes along with the idea of how can we get these stakeholders to come to the table when it's so easy to pass on responsibility and say, well, other people are accountable for this, not so much us. What are those encouraging motivating factors?
I think they're exactly the same as in every mediation. And one of the I've written a book recently which is called Conflict Revolution, Mediating Evil, War, Injustice, and Terrorism, in which I try to look at these issues a little bit more closely. But the basic argument in the book is that conflicts are essentially human. And because they are human, what it means is that they have similar characteristics on all scales. So that there's something similar between a conflict between two kids on a playground and between the heads of nation states. And what this means is that we can then take what we've learned from the individual mediations that we have done over the last several decades and turn them into mechanisms for showing people how to do this on a local level. So I think in every conflict, people adopt exactly the same attitude. They have a tendency to blame other people for the problem, not to look at their own responsibility. And the whole focus of conflict resolution, of mediation, is to share that responsibility, to share the nature of the problem, and to share the implementation of solutions. That's not a specific answer to your question, but let me just answer it this way. The mood in Copenhagen, and I'd like Eileen to maybe say whether she thinks this is right, but the mood in Copenhagen was very much one of this is a shared problem and we have got to address this. It was an extraordinary event. It was the first time, I think, in history that all of the countries of the world have gathered together to solve a problem that isn't quite entirely here yet, and have been joined by tens of thousands of people from around the world who came just in order to be able to say, we are concerned about this. That was really pretty amazing. So that was, in my view, the success of Copenhagen. The failure came because there wasn't a way for people to talk to each other and have those conversations with each other. It was really a failure of process because all of the NGOs were located in one room and all of the delegates were located in another room. And you could go in and watch the delegates have their conversations, but it was typical diplomatic process, meaning everyone was giving all the right speeches, but the real action was taking place behind the scenes where a lot of arm twisting was taking place.
So is there a mechanism for translating what's happening in the NGO space to the delegate space? Is there a way of creating a PowerPoint presentation that shows the next step so that there can be forums and regions can be represented at a round table that brainstorms a consensus building format for adopting a mediation framework?
Yes, there are a number of different ways. Once you're an NGO, for example, the next conference is going to take place in Cancun in December. And anyone who wants to can go. And then what Mediators Beyond Borders is going to be doing is scheduling a number of press conferences. And at those press conferences, you can present PowerPoint slides. You can duplicate materials and put them in delegates' mailboxes. All of those are things that we have tried. But the most effective is to send teams of people to meet with delegates and talk to them about mediation. And we've been doing that fairly consistently and with good results. But the basic response on the part of the delegates is, we think your idea is a terrific one. We've got our hands full.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. They do have their hands full. But one of the reasons they have their hands full is because they're not using conflict resolution techniques to be able to reach agreements in ways that are not adversarial or based on coercion. And there is a lot of coercion that is, there was a lot of coercion that was taking place behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ken. I want to let people know this archive will be put up tomorrow onto the website, and there will be a forum, so lots of questions and comments can continue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I really want to appreciate the fact that everyone came on and listened.